Blog Talk Radio.
Woohoo! Hey everybody, it's time for the Love Channel Show. Sit back and enjoy the show. Everyone, welcome to the Love Channel Show this Tuesday evening, every Tuesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm always so happy to be here. That song was called Illusions, and it's by Diane Garris, and you can find her music and all the other indie music musicians I have here. My goodness, Birdie Bird, you're all excited. Yes, we're on the radio. That's my co-host over there. He's this little parakeet who has such a big voice. Anyhow, you can find Diane Garris and all the other indie musicians that I have on the show actually on my website. I have a link for them. And my website is www.pamelacumins.com. You can also go there through successfulrel.com. I'm very excited for the guests that we have tonight. It's a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, and it's actually what got me on my journey many years ago when I was searching for God, and a lot of the people who I were around at the time were very Christian or Jewish, and I was looking for a different way to go. And when I read about near-death, reincarnation, it just made so much sense to me. I mean, I can't make you believe that, but it just made so much sense to me, and it helped me along the path. So I'm really excited to have Diane Goebel on tonight, and I will give you a little information about her. She had a transformative near-death experience in 1971 at the age of 30 when she drowned in a white water river accident. She since then has created one of the country's first stress management centers in Florida. That was back in 1986 before anyone ever heard of stress, and later partnered with her sister in a body-mind healing center, one of its first kinds. Several years later, she became a certified hypnotherapist and specialized in past life regression as a therapeutic tool. She also became an ordained minister with the Congregational Church of Practical Theology and has practiced as a psycho-spiritual counselor for the past 25 years. A few years ago, Diane created a program to train teachers, healers, nurses, and hospice workers to be transition guides and teach their clients the art of conscious dying. She currently writes a blog, Let's Talk About Death and Dying, and is the author of 5 books, and that's actually how I found her on Smashwords. You know, being a Smashword author, I always stand behind the good Smashword authors, and her books are awesome, so please check them out. Diane is semi-retired and lives in Oregon. Her website is beyondtheveil.net. You can find that information on the front of the show. So let me bring her on. I was afraid to mute her again because I lost her once, so hopefully I won't lose her again. Hello, Diane. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Great,
yeah,
great. Well,
I don't know what happened the first time. Sometimes this new technology just drives me crazy.
Well, and, you know, honestly, sometimes it is Blog Talk. Blog Talk can get a little crazy sometime. Maybe it's the new moon. And I did mute you, so I won't mute you anymore. But I want to thank you so much for coming on the show because I know you don't do a lot of public appearances, even on the radio. So I appreciate you coming and sharing your story.
Oh,
so,
well, I'd love to do it.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, I have a bunch of questions I'd like to ask you, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Well, my first question was, because obviously I read your book, but there's a lot I don't know about you, and obviously the listeners don't know. What was life like for you before you had your near-death experience?
Well, I guess I would say it was pretty normal. I mean, I was married. I had 3 kids. My husband had an unusual job as a motion picture cameraman, or at least he was in the beginning stages of his career in that. But, you know, we lived in the suburbs of Chicago, and I had worked several years myself, and then after I had kids, I got to be a stay-at-home mom, which was great. And so, yeah, we traveled because when he would get on a picture, we'd go away for several months at a time. That was the only unusual thing about our life. But other than that, we were pretty normal.
Hmm. Okay, like everybody else.
And
we weren't
religious. We were Catholic when we met, and we married in the church. But we both kind of fell away from religion about the same time, I guess, and I would say at the time of my experience, I was pretty much agnostic. I really didn't think about it, didn't care. I just never was really a church-going person. You know, you just get involved with life, and that's kind of where we were.
Wonderful, wonderful. So with your 3 children, I guess you didn't raise them at that point religiously at all.
No, I mean, they were baptized because we were still in the church then, but, yeah, no, they weren't at all.
Right.
Because they were young at the time. I would think I was 24 when my oldest, when my first was born, and so this was like 6 years later, so they were, and the oldest was 6.
Right, right. So, okay, well, if you could tell everyone what happened in order to cause this near-death experience?
Okay. Well, we were on a picture in Georgia, and we spent the summer, and it was up near the Three Corners where North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia all come together. It's kind of wild, mountainous, Smoky Mountain territory, a lot of rivers running through it, and the movie was all filmed on the river. So the guys were pretty familiar with the river, and on a weekend, well, Sundays was their day off, sometimes some of the people would take rafts and, you know, go out on the river. And so we had done this once before with some other people, but this time we were with, he and I were the only ones who had actually run this particular course before, and so we had two four-person rafts. So there are eight of us. And what you do is you drive in through the woods until you find the river. Well, actually, you don't even find the river. You have to get out of the car and carry the rafts to find the river. That's how deep in the jungle, if you want to call it, it was. It was, I don't remember, maybe 4 or 5 hour trip down the river, and then they would pick us up at the end point. And so we had a wonderful time. It was a great day. It was a beautiful day. The only difference was that it depends on how much it's rained as to how deep the water in the river is. So the first time we went, the water was high, and when we got to this last set of rapids, we were able to go around this bad place. And it's called a hydraulic, and what happens is the water goes over some rocks, and it's like a small waterfall, maybe 5-6 foot waterfall, and the water pours down into a hole, and the water, the action of the water is like kind of like a washing machine. It's on its side. It turns around and sucks things into it, and it can't get out. So, like if a tree branch or a kayak or a raft gets stuck in there, it gets stuck in there. And and that's what happened to us. The second time the water was low, and we couldn't go around the outside like we had gone the previous time. So we had to go through this obstacle. we took everything out of the first raft, and the four of us from my raft guided their raft into where it had to go out into the river and then turn and then go through this section and go downriver. And it worked perfectly. You know, we got them right in there, right into the current, and they just went down and over, and it was great. And so we just kind of all looked at each other and said, well, that was so easy. Why don't we just go? Well, what we forgot was that we helped them with their raft, and we had nobody to help us with our raft. And so we got caught by the current, and the raft got turned around backwards. And so we went over this fall backwards. And I had been in the front of the raft, so now I was in the back of the raft. So I went down last and fell out, started to fall out the back of the raft between the raft and the waterfall. And as I slid out, one of the guys grabbed onto my arm and was trying to pull me back in. But the suction of the water was so strong, and the action of the water underneath, this hydraulic action, was sucking me down, and then it would push me back up. And when it did this, it also filled the raft with water. And then when it would buck again, it would dump the water out of the raft. So it first threw one of the other women out. She went out the front end. So the two men were left in the raft, and the raft was like a bucking bronco. And I'm being held by my arm and being sucked down and pushed up and pounded into the rocks. And you know, it must have been a terrible-looking scene from the outside, but to me, I was very calmly thinking, I'm going to die here. There's no question about this. Now, what's the best way to die? As I said, while this is happening, and very calmly I'm thinking, well, I could get pounded into the rocks until I'm just beat to a pulp, or I could drown here in the waterfall. So I think the best thing to do is to let go and just go down under the water and drown. And I was very okay with that. It was not like, oh, my God, this is terrible, or, you know, there's no panic. It was very calmly, okay, I'm going to die. And so the next time I was able to get up and get a breath, which I was able to every once in a while when I'd get pushed up, I shouted, let go. And I heard one of the guys say, are you sure? And I said, yes. And so he let go, and I remember getting sucked down under the water and knowing I was going to die. I just breathed in the water when I went under. And everything went black, which is kind of what I expected. You know, having been an agnostic, I thought, well, you die, that's it, lights go out. And so that's what happened. Everything went black. And then, like an instant later, all of a sudden, I'm up above all of this, looking down and watching what's happening. Completely aware of everything going around, like above the trees. That's how high up I am. And I see my husband and my sister, who had been in the first raft, come running upstream because they saw all the stuff that got dumped out of the raft floating downriver. And, you know, we're running up to see what had happened. And I saw him go out on a rock and look, and he was shouting to the two men who were still in the raft looking for me. But they couldn't hear each other because the roar of the water was so loud. And I thought, well, he's going to try to jump in the water and try to save me. Well, that's ridiculous. I'm dead. He can't save me. And when I thought that, all of a sudden I was down there next to him, and I, like, put my arm out to try to stop him from going in the water, and my arm went right through him. And I looked, and I didn't really have an arm. And I realized that I didn't have a body. I just thought I still was, you know, me in the body, but I was still me. I just didn't have the body anymore. And with that thought, I was suddenly pulled away from there and into the tunnel experience, as has been described, although I would not say it was a tunnel, but that's the closest word that we have. So it's a bad picture image because people think of a tunnel that they've seen on Earth, and it's not that kind of a tunnel. So I don't like that word, but I kind of have to use it. But let me back up just a minute, because only a few years ago, in talking to my now ex-husband and asking him what he remembered, he said when he was standing out on that rock, he had the thought that if he jumped in and he drowned, that nobody would be there to take care of the children, and so he didn't jump in to try to save me. And I felt like that was the message I was trying to give him. So it's almost like he got my message, don't try to save me.
That's interesting.
Because he thought I was dead. You know, I was gone, right. Nobody knew where I was, and so he thought I was dead and that, you know, that he shouldn't jump in. So anyway, from there, I went into this tunnel experience. To me, it's more like when I watch, like, Star Trek, and you see the Enterprise go into warp speed, and you see these lights go zooming by it. It's kind of like that, but on one hand, I felt like I was going the speed of light, but on the other hand, I felt like I wasn't moving. So I didn't know whether I was moving toward the light or the light was coming towards me. It was like this timeless state where there was no real motion, but something was happening, and it's very hard to find the words to describe that. So I'll just kind of leave it at that. But so anyways, I'm traveling in whatever way this is. I suddenly realize there's a presence next to me, and I can only say it was a being of light. It was not a religious figure. It was not my friend Charlie. It was not a relative. It was a being of light, and it was a being of light who had known me all of my lives. And it was like, oh, now I understand reincarnation. Now I understand. I've done this before. This isn't the first time I died. I just forgot this when I was alive. And I kind of laughed, and I thought, well, wouldn't this be wonderful if we knew this when we were alive, that this is what death is?
Yes, it would.
It would make so much difference in the way we live our lives if we knew that there was more, there definitely was more. It wasn't this whole religious thing. And, you know, to me, having read the Bible before, you know, as a young person, I just thought of it as a bunch of stories and interesting, but I didn't believe it in the way that a lot of Christians believe it. But all of a sudden it made sense to me, and it was like, oh, they did, they had it right, but they left some stuff out, and people didn't quite get it. But really, there's a lot of truth in the Bible. But it's kind of like the secret, you know, they left part of it out. And they just ask you to believe it, to take it on faith, because they can't really explain it. And that's because there's part of it's left out. And that's that we do this over and over again, and that's what life is about, that this is a spiritual journey we're on. We're not human beings with souls. We're souls that become human beings on occasion. So anyway, so this whole reincarnation thing had made much more sense to me. And so, I mean, I could go on and on and on. I had quite a long experience, but let me just skip ahead to the way it ended. And I did, at the end of this, we did reach the light, and we got to, like, it was almost like a doorway, or a huge window, and we hovered at this point, and I looked out on what I can only describe as an incredibly beautiful scenery. You know, more beautiful than anything I've seen on Earth, just landscape, celestial scape, whatever you want to call it. It was just incredible, and I did a lot of traveling around and learned a lot of stuff while I was there. But at the end, this being of light and I approached this, like, crystal city, and we were, as we were traveling towards it, we just, you know, floated by thought, okay, we're going here, or this is interesting, let me see that, and I would go wherever my thoughts took me, and information was just, it was like a dump of information, just universal knowledge, however you want to put that, and it all made perfect sense, and it was more of a remembering than a, you know, here's some interesting thing. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember I was here before and did this before and knew this before. So we come to this crystal, towards this crystal city, and we're discussing whether I want to return to my body. And I didn't. I really didn't. I was really excited about where I was and what I was learning and doing and remembering, and this was just, I wanted to stay. So this being told me that if I decided to go back, that there was basically more that I could do in this lifetime for my spiritual growth, and that if I chose to go back, I would be given information that I would be able to remember, that I was asked to pass on. In other words, it was like messages that I would receive and stuff that I would learn, and the reason for that was for me to pass it on. And they're, you know, just making me one of many other messengers who are trying to help humanity overcome the darkness that we seem to have fallen into by bringing messages from the light. So I thought, well, you know, that sounds pretty interesting. I might be interested in doing that. And before I could even think about it again, I was, like, sucked into this building. And it was so tall that you couldn't see the top of it. And it was, like, kind of conical shaped, like a very tall cone. And I went into it and flew, like, spiraled upwards through it. And it was like I was in this humongous library of, you know, it literally bookshelves, but no, it wasn't bookshelves, but it was knowledge in some form, and the only way I can describe it is books, but it wasn't books. But, and I didn't realize this until about 10 years later, that I was absorbing knowledge as I went through this. Because 7 years later, I went back to college, and it all came back to me. That's what I'm referring to. But anyway, as I spiraled up through the top of this building, I started to see that I was approaching the top of it, and I thought, well, this is interesting. What's going to happen when I reach the top of this building? And with that thought, all of a sudden I did, and it just burst into like a billion colored shards of glass, just shimmering. It was this amazing sight, and at that very same instant, my head popped out of the water in the river.
Wow.
And I was fine. I don't know how I got from up there to down there. I don't know how my body made it through all the rocks and under the trees and around the boulders that were in the rapids that I had to, that my body had to transverse to get from there to where I ended up. I don't know how that happened. I don't ever remember struggling in the water or trying to hold my breath or fighting for breath or any of that. I just was down at the bottom of the rapids and fine.
Wow. Wow. Did they say that your ex-husband and your sister, how long were you gone for?
Well,
in the water.
It's one of those things that it happened so fast and it was so crazy that, you know, who knew? That funny
okay.
thing, you looked at a watch, you know, it was a matter of minutes.
Okay.
It wasn't 20 minutes, but it had to be more than 5 minutes. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know how long I was under the raft before my body was spit out. I don't know how long it took me to get from there to there. I mean, it was only probably a two or three minute run by raft. But I don't know what my body had to go through to get to where I was.
Right, because you weren't in your body. But meanwhile,
right.
In the 2 minutes that you were, you know, your body was on Earth, and the 2 minutes that you were over on the other side, heaven, whatever you choose to call it, I'm sure it felt more like than 2 minutes.
It was like a century.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
The amount of stuff that happened to me, that I experienced, that I did, you know, it was like it was a long, long time. But on Earth, it was only a matter of a few minutes, you know, let's say 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. I'm just curious because as a reader, one of the questions that I call a four-letter word is when. Everybody wants to know when, and I try and explain that, you know, with the angels and our guides, time is different there than it is here, and that's just a beautiful explanation of it, what you just said.
There is no time there, that's the thing, because it didn't seem like time, but with all that I experienced, it had to have been more than 5 minutes. You know, how could
right.
I have done all that? So, yeah.
Yeah,
there
interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you had this near-death experience. What was it like? Because just in case, because people listen in the archives and there's someone who's, you know, just experienced a near-death experience, which I never had, but, you know, there's many people who had, and they're going through a hard time. What was the adjustment period like for you after that happened?
Well, in a nutshell, my entire life fell apart.
Okay.
Because we're talking about 1971. Nobody knew about this. Nobody talked about this. I had never read anything about this or heard anything about this or seen anything on TV or movies. There were things now that, you know, I've looked back and I know there were, but I didn't come across them. I didn't find Raymond Moody's book, which he wrote in 1975, until about 1987. And it was around that same time that I picked up the first book that said anything, and it wasn't about near death. It was Ruth Montgomery's book, Strangers Among Us, and she talked about walk-ins, but the experience she described was very similar to an NDE, and it was the first book that I read that I went, oh my God, other people have had these kinds of experiences. So, of course, now I realize that in looking back, whether it's the Bible or the ancient Egyptians, they've been having near-death experiences since time began, and that's where all this religious information came from, was people trying to put it into words, trying to describe what they saw when they had a near-death experience. Because I could see all of the biblical descriptions and the, you know, I could understand all of the descriptions of the other side, and it just depends on the words you use. So back then, they had a different vocabulary and a different way of describing things than they did when in biblical times and than we do now. So we're just trying to describe the same experiences, but we're using different words.
Right, right. And I can kind of understand what you went through, but in a different sense. For instance, when my mother, a week before she passed away, she came to see me in a dream, and no words were exchanged. It was just this overwhelming feeling of love that I've never, I never felt in a dream. I've never felt awake. It was so beautiful. It was so pure. And the only thing that I could think of is, this is what it must be like when we die, when we're with God. It was just incredible. And words can't explain it. And I'm sure you can understand what I'm talking about because you were immense in that.
Absolutely. And that the whole experience, as they say, through the tunnel, was that incredibly overwhelming feeling of being loved and accepted and, you know, like any feelings that you ever had of being inadequate or unloved just totally disappear, because this is, you know, more than a mother's love, more than a child's love for a parent. It's just, and it's all through you. It's just, hard to describe, hard to put in words.
Right, right. And I can understand, because that, it wasn't a dream. It was a visitation. I could never put it into words. So I can, So I think it was in your book that it took you about 15 years to come out, I want to call it the near-death experience closet. Is that correct? And
that's what I said when I read that book and finally realized that other people had had these experiences, because I didn't talk about it for those 15 years. I was afraid to, because when I did right after the experience and I tried to put it into words, which I didn't have, I just, my ex-husband said, "You said you went someplace. What did that mean?" You know, I that was all I could stammer at that point. And when I did try to tell him more and a couple of other people, they just looked at me like I was insane. And because I'd never heard of it before, I stopped talking about it for 15 years.
Right, right. So when you did start to find out what happened exactly to you and came out of the closet and started talking to people about it, and what was life like for you then? How did your life change?
Well, backing up a minute, the thing that happened afterwards was not being able to talk about it and making me realize that life was very different than I had always believed it to be, made it difficult to continue living the life that I was living, because I was really living a lie. I was very unhappy, and I had never admitted that to myself. And it ended up where my husband could almost no longer relate to me, because I don't know, that some of the trivia of life became so unimportant to me that I don't know, it really messed with our relationship, and we were never able to put it back together. And so his almost abandoning me and then later trying to take my children away from me because he thought I had basically lost my mind led me into a deep depression and trying to figure out my life and what happened. You know, it was just, I went through some really awful down times, and ended up 7 years later, which that has become a number that it takes about 7 years for a person to really integrate the experience into their life and get back on some sort of livable track. What happened to me at 7 years was I went back to school to study psychology to try to understand what had happened to me, but without admitting it. I mean, it wasn't until I was in graduate school and went to a colloquium where one of my professors started talking about things like this, and I said to him, you know, if you start talking like this, you're going to change religion and the way people think about life. And he says, yep, that's what I'm doing. And I thought, oh, my God, if I start talking about what happened to me, people are going to, wow, you know. So lights started going off. And it was after that I got involved with people who were sort of in the New Age movement. But I started reading a lot of books and a lot of thought leaders back then, you know, Scott Peck and Alan Watts and Ram Dass and Maharishi Markesh and Krishnamurti. And, you know, I started reading all these books, and it was like, oh, my God, there's this whole world out there that I didn't know anything about, and I'm connected to it because I had this experience. So that's how it kind of evolved and led to my kind of awakening of consciousness that there's a whole lot more life than we're led to believe, and we're kind of kept in the dark and almost like a slave-like mentality that we believe what we're told, and the wool's been pulled over our eyes. And people like me who have stepped out of the world for a minute and said, well, there's something else going on here, are now starting to talk, and it's kind of changing the world, which is really interesting.
So,
making a lot of people think.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing. So, So I have another question for you, because you've gone to the other side and back. And as you said, it's not so much about, you know, paying the bills and having children. I mean, we obviously have to do that in some form, or, you know, to go on and to survive. But really, why are we here on this planet?
Well, yeah, I've been trying to put that into words. and it's definitely a struggle. What I've gotten out of it to this point, I would say, is that we're spiritual beings, and we have a greater journey that we can barely understand as human beings. I mean, we can't comprehend God, so we can't comprehend who we really are. People tend to think that, or if you put it in these terms, we're human and divine. We're both at once. But if everybody knew that, like Jesus said, you can do everything, I can do and more. Mm. If we knew what that really meant, as in a human body, we could hardly contain that amount of power. And most people tend to think that that means something like a Superman, like we can fly and leap over tall buildings and things like that. But that's not what it is at all. It's all about learning about peace and compassion and living together and loving each other and the planet. And I think that we're meant as human-type beings to be able to travel throughout the universe, but we need to learn a lot more because, I mean, we can't even get along with our neighbors in our family, much less other countries. How are we going to get along with beings from other planets? And I believe that there are, that life exists on other planets and that we're meant to connect with them and bring the universe closer together. I think that it's going to be time travel as opposed to rocket ships, but I think that each lifetime we gain more and more as more divine beings, and we will be able to use the powers of being divine in compassionate ways. It's like again, Jesus tried to show us to love each other. That's what's important. Having a lot of money or a lot of power and a lot of things are not important. But that's kind of the way the materialist mind is, scientific aspect is driven us to, you know, lead a material life. But and being more spiritual doesn't mean we should all become monks and sit around contemplating our navels. It's, you know, it's more than, it's community, and it's, we're all one and we're all involved. And it's, I don't know if I'm making any sense, but like I say, I'm still trying to put it all into words.
Yeah, no, you're making a lot of sense. Basically, what you're saying is that we're here to, I mean, this is least my thoughts, and I haven't had a near-death experience, but I really believe that the Earth is a giant schoolroom that teaches us about love and compassion and being kind to each other and living a good life and also living an honest life and doing what you feel and what you're intuitively, you know, supposed to contribute to this planet, if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're certainly not here to have wars and try to kill each other. You know, that's just absurd.
Right. It's treating each other with kindness. There's so many things that I want to talk to you about in 18 minutes, and obviously I'm not going to. You had mentioned earlier, and it's obviously in your book, about once you cross to the other side and you were with this loving being that's always been with you, I guess it's more than a family, a part of you or whatever, that you instantly knew that you had done this before.
Mm-hmm.
So can, you know, about reincarnation. So can you go a little bit into karma and reincarnation?
Sure. Well, karma as a word means action. So it has to do with energy. And energy is positive or negative. It's not good and bad. It's positive and negative. What we're seeking in all things is balance. So karma is a balance, learning to balance our energy. And we need an equal amount of compassion and strength. People who are too compassionate can become non-functional in other areas because they're so concerned with helping others that they even neglect themselves. So strength is important, and people who only deal with strength are the ones who end up fighting in wars. So what you're trying to find is a balance. So the way reincarnation and karma work together is that we learn with each lifetime a different aspect of certain things. And I used to work with a woman who was one of the pioneers in past life regression therapy, Dr. June Blitzer. And she, the last book that she wrote, was called Journey of a Soul, something like that. She had herself regressed by me and several other people to hundreds of past lives, and she put them into classifications. So in like maybe 100 lives, she studied poverty. So she studied poverty from all different aspects, and wealth is the opposite of poverty. So she studied lifetimes in all aspects of having money and not having money or wealth or however that's measured. Another one might be compassion. Another one might be, have certain personality characteristics where you're learning to be a more compassionate person, so you're going to live some lifetimes as being not compassionate at all, or being, you know, being a victim, or So you'll live different lifetimes. Taking murder as an example, you may be a murderer in one lifetime. You may be murdered in another lifetime. You may be the parent of a child who's murdered. You may be a child whose parent is murdered. You may be a partner of, you know, so you'll live different lifetimes, experiencing everything from different angles. And that's how we learn compassion. So we may live thousands of lifetimes because in the timeless state that's beyond the physical life, each lifetime might be a minute, comparatively speaking. We live a minute as a murderer and a minute as a victim, but the lifetime on Earth might be 50 or 100 years, whatever. So that's kind of relative. But each experience is information that we bring back when we leave our body and integrate it into our whole being to really, truly learn compassion. So it's just kind of an ongoing process that jumps between, you know, and the lives don't follow necessarily. Like if you were this in one life, you're not necessarily the opposite in the next life. It may be 10 lifetimes where you deal with that again. And when we make soul contracts on the other side with other beings who we intend to interact with in a physical lifetime, we may be traveling with the same soul group. So we never lose each other. You know, people who say, oh, when we die, we'll never see them again. Well, the person that we were is only part of the whole being that we are. So we're always all of the people that we were, but we're never the same person. In other words, it's not Diane that reincarnates. Diane is just one of the bodies that I happened to live in when I was in a human lifetime. So is that making some sense?
It makes a lot of sense to me, a lot of sense. I've been into this for a long time, so it's really just a way to grow. There was a woman I did many years ago, it was in the 90s, I did a group past life regression. And I was one of the, one of the students. And one thing she said to me, and this stood out because somebody asked about karma. It might have even been me. And I asked her to explain it to me. And she used an example where she had this client who had been gone through about, I think it was 7 surgeries, and she couldn't understand why. And she regressed her back into the caveman time. It was a very old time. And she was a warrior, and she stabbed someone 7 times. So basically, she had been under the knife 7 times, but in a different way.
Wow.
And I just thought that was a nice way of explaining what karma was.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah, I thought that was really good. So one of the things that you said in the book, and I think the past lives, talking about the past lives, but also in this lifetime, is how we mirror each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you want to go into that a little bit? Or?
Well, that one of the things that I have in this lifetime is being a mirror for a lot of people. It can be very disconcerting because one of the things that happens when you're a mirror is that you show people what they don't want to know about themselves. You tend to show, you either come out and say it, you know, you're up front with people, or you realize that what they're doing and you call them on it. And as a therapist, I had a lot of people say, are you psychic? Because I was always telling them what they were showing me, you know, and like they weren't aware. They are not, the person isn't aware of what it is that they're doing that causes reactions in other people. So I would tell them, and they go, well, you must be psychic. How would you know that? And I said, well, you just told me that. So that's the problem, one of the problems with being a mirror. But I think it's like we need people who are mirrors to help us grow. Otherwise, we're in denial. You know, it's like being an alcoholic and not being able to admit it. Until you admit it, you'll always be an alcoholic because you don't recognize it.
Right.
So
if
somebody's a gossip or if somebody's, a backstabber or something like that, if somebody doesn't point it out, they'll keep doing it because they don't see that they're doing it. What they complain that other people do is what they themselves are doing, but they don't see themselves doing it.
Interesting. So we have about 9 minutes left. And I know you do past life regression therapy, and I've had it done to myself, and I'm also a hypnotherapist, so it's been quite some time since I've done it with people. I didn't do it extensively as you, but can you let our listeners know how can past life regression help us in today's lifetime?
Well, I haven't used it a lot lately either, but the main thing that I got out of it years ago when Dr. Bletcher and I were working on it was that if somebody has an issue that they can't resolve, something that continually happens, they're in a pattern and they can't break the pattern, sometimes age regression will uncover it. So if they go back to their childhood and they remember a traumatic thing that they had repressed because it was just too much and they may have developed some sort of defense mechanism to cover it up and it was so bad they wanted to pretend that it didn't happen, so eventually they forgot it. So age regression hypnosis will often uncover an issue like that and they're able to go, oh, now I see, I understand, and they can start processing it and working through it. But sometimes the issue goes so deep that even that doesn't help, or they can't find the issue, or they do find some issues, but it's kind of like if you look at a rope and it has knots on it every once in a while, every time something happens that relates to the original issue, there's another knot in the rope. And so therapy can often unravel the knots kind of one at a time. You can make a leap with an age regression that often unravels the entire string and frees the person. But if it goes way back into a past life, it has to be done in a different way. So you go into past life regression, and even if you don't believe it, even if it doesn't make sense to you, even if it doesn't work the way we say it does, what I've always found is that whatever comes up, even if a person thinks they're making it up, whatever comes up relates to the issue. And a good past life regression therapist who is also quite intuitive can help the person figure it out. And so it could be that, 1,000 lifetimes ago, you and this other person had this conflagration, and it stayed with you through many lifetimes, and it was so deep that you were either afraid to release it in a lifetime, because that's something we do on the soul contract level, is we decide what karma we want to release in a lifetime. So some people who have like a lot of illnesses in one lifetime or a lot of bad things happen to them have taken on a lifetime where they want to release a lot of karma in that lifetime. So they bring on a lot of stuff and they think they're going to be strong enough to get through and wipe it all out in one lifetime. Sometimes we spread it out so that we only have a little karma to deal with in some lives and life isn't quite so traumatic. But the ones that go back into past lifetimes are just issues that we have tried to put off dealing with. And if they're strong, if it's a behavior that's really disrupting our life, it's telling us that we need to work on it. And so if if traditional therapy doesn't work and age regression doesn't work, then past life regression is a possible way to go to release the energy so you can start resolving the issue and process it out.
I agree 100%. I remember that I had, we're not going to have enough time for me to talk about it. We have about 4 minutes left. So I guess what I want to ask you is, what is the best way to live today? I mean, we can go into past lives, and they can get in touch with you at beyondtheveil.net and read your books. But for today, what would you say is the best way to live today?
Learn to meditate. I mean, I think meditation is the greatest thing. And, you know, whether it's stress management or trying to clear your mind, learn to meditate. And I listened to a YouTube video of a young monk teaching a technique, and he said, it's not a big deal. Just sit quietly, and if you start thinking, just repeat the word think. Thinking. Because you should, like, use it like a mantra. Whatever it is you're doing, if you're worrying, just worrying to yourself, worrying. And that the word will stop the thoughts and will allow you to meditate. And if you would do that every day, it would really turn your life around.
I agree 100%. So what is the best way? I know you're semi-retired. Do you have any upcoming things that you do in Oregon?
Well, I have one of my books is called How to Die Consciously, and it's a process of learning to move into the death process with your eyes wide open, sort of. And I've had it as an e-book, and I revised it a bit, and I'm going to put it into print. So I'm hoping by about June that I will have it available in print, and the new title is going to be Stepping into the Light. Reframing death from a near-death experience perspective. So that's what I'm working on, and you can get information on my blog or on my website about it when it comes out.
Awesome, wonderful. You know, so we have about 2 minutes left. Anything that you would like to add to this?
No. Do you have another question?
Okay. I do. What is a good way for people to get in touch with their past lives? If they can't, let's say they can't afford a past life regressionist, or they don't want
it.
They're too private.
I have some techniques in the book about that. Keep a journal, write down stuff that pops into your mind at odd times. Write down a list of places that interest you, periods in history, kinds of clothing, books. You know, just kind of write down a bunch of stuff. And after you've got a bunch of stuff written down, like over several months, look at it all and see what fits together, kind of group it together. And you may see a preponderance of lives in of interest in Egypt or in old English history, or, you know, something will pop out, and like a whole bunch of things will be connected, and it'll give you some insight into where you have probably lived past lives, not necessarily who you were. And who you were isn't really important. Most, if you've regressed enough people, they're usually very common lives. Very few Cleopatras and, not famous people. They're just average people. So it's really not important who you were. It's what you learned, and what you learned will show up in interests that you have that relate to lives that you've lived before. So you'll find a list of those in the book.
Wonderful. So we're about to be cut off, everyone. So please check her out at beyondtheveil.net. You can see it in the front of the show. Diane, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a real honor. And,
you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, and we'll keep in touch. And good night, everyone. Namaste. Bye-bye.
Namaste.